Greetings from Long Time No See, the podcast. Every week, we'll be inviting two blindfolded comedians to answer a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Now, let's remove those blindfolds and start the show.
Hi!
What would your opening line with your celebrity crush be?
Loved you in Harry Potter.
Worst date you've been on?
A man bit my neck mole off once.
You did what?
A man bit my neck mole off.
Oh my God, Jack almost fell off his chair.
Be sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast.
Hey, pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
The Opus, an exploration of legendary records and their ongoing legacy. Not just their history, but how this music continues to evolve. We're opening the vault on classic records upon re-release, delving into their inner workings and their lasting impact. Maybe you're a longtime fan and wants to go a little deeper. Maybe you're a first-time listener and you're curious to hear more. Either way, you're in the right place. Find us at Consequence of Sound or wherever you tune in to podcasts.
Consequence Podcast Network.
To all of you amazing pod people out there, I'm your host once again, Leo Phillips. My name is not once again, it's Leo Phillips, but I'm here once again. And this must be the gig. It's a little podcast about the world of live music. Every single week, I bring you a fascinating conversation from the beating heart of the live music and performance scene. And that could really mean a musician or a festival founder, a choreographer, a comedian, an actor, really anyone obsessed with performance, not just of live music, performance in general, in the very way that we are. But before we dig into this week's fantastic interview with Andrew Bird, I know you saw who we have before you press play. Let's check in with our constant companion here at the TMBTG Studios, Engineer Adam. Hello.
You say that faster every week, and I'm impressed
every week.
It's just a skill that you've developed over these months.
I think it's because I once watched an autocomplete, the Wired autocomplete YouTube video. The second type of YouTube video that I watch,
because yes.
The first is Hi-Ho Kids,
well,
try things.
We are in common on that.
Oh, yeah, because we watch it together. Michael Caine was on an autocomplete Wired interview, and basically every single question he was asked, he had like 10 minutes. He gave an answer for 10 minutes.
And you've just...
I loved it. You want to become the anti-Michael Caine. Let's go.
Yeah.
No, I love some Mickey Caine-y.
If you're looking at morning, evening, white, black, Michael Caine, Lior Phillips, these are just the opposites that come up in the world.
Cucumbers and Napolitana sauce.
Yes, I will agree with that.
Okay,
I will agree with that
100%. I will bring it up on this podcast once. And
yes.
Once only. I saw somebody on one of those crowdsourcing stupid Twitter question things the other day,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
That I've taken the bait once before.
We're talking social media. Here we go.
Social media. Anyway, so somebody asked, what is your embarrassing home snack?
Yes.
And I wanted to answer, but I have so many. And some of those were not even that bad. They were civilized little barbell cheeses made into a sandwich. Like, none of
it. That's not embarrassing.
That's not embarrassing.
No.
I'll tell you what's embarrassing. Cucumbers cut in the shape of a coin.
Uh-huh.
Particularly maybe between a dime and a quarter.
Oh, yeah. You're getting the American coin sizes. I'm into it. Yeah, yeah.
And pasta sauce over that. That, my friends, would have gone viral.
Do you...
I'm sorry.
Do you warm this up?
I've had sugar. What?
Do you warm this up then?
No.
So cold pasta sauce.
Cold? Oh, shit. dived into that one. I slinkied into
you
that one.
You said no as if I were crazy also.
Listen, you can't question. I've been freelancing since 2009.
Yes.
You can't question the snacks that I've come up with. Some would say that they own me.
Yes.
I do not own the snacks.
These are what you call desperation snacks.
No, these are what you call life. There are no meals anymore. It's just a day of cucumbers, and it's disgusting, and I'm so embarrassed. I wouldn't admit it on Twitter, but I'm admitting it on my podcast.
Yes.
Now you
this
know
I love
you. This
is for you, special friends. Yes.
I feel so embarrassed because Andrew Bird fans are going to be like, what the hell is going on here? So how have you been since our little trip to Austin?
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about that for a minute.
I'm happy to.
As a podcast, made a little jaunt down to South by Southwest, which was a wonderful experience.
It really was. I was asked by the lovely Moose at Marauder, which is a boutique agency who run Independent Venue Week here in the US. If you don't know anything about Independent Venue Week, just Google it. Basically, what it is, I will save you time. You're tired. It is a week-long celebration of the spirit of live music through independent venues. And the reason why I said yes is because not only were there other panelists that I really love, like Tessa Morris from the UC Theatre in Berkeley, she's the marketing director there, and James Moody, otherwise known as Moody, who is not Moody at all, I gotta say. He's
cheerful. Yeah, he's a sweetie.
Who started Mohawk in Austin, mm-hmm. which
that
we love.
Legendary venue.
And they were all panelists, and I was moderating an amazing panel on independent venues.
Something you said in that panel, which I was so struck by, and I agree completely 100%, is that one of the first things you do when you go to a new place is you go to their independent venues to really get an idea of what the city is about.
It's the
and
best
that's so,
way.
That's so amazing.
Well, there's three landmarks. So you go to a bookstore, a cinema, and maybe those are just the three things that I really love.
No, I'm with you 100%.
So we discussed on the panel, and obviously shout out to anybody who was there. There was such a warm audience, and to the extent that I made fun of every single person who asked a question.
I think that was unusual for a South by Southwest panel, but it was very fitting
well,
for what
there was a mic. Okay, let's map out the visuals for our listeners. There was a room, a panel on a stage, very uncomfy, right? You know, kind of teachery.
It felt comfy to me.
It felt comfy, right? And then there was a microphone on a stand, a lone microphone mm-hmm. on a stand in the middle of the aisle, in the middle of the room. So if you wanted, during the Q&A portion, which was the last 10 minutes of the panel, if you wanted to ask a question, you had to remove yourself from your comfortable, warm seat and get up and saunter across the room and ask your question. And in that process, I thought it was hella funny to make light of the way in which strangers who were at the panel and had been sitting for 45 minutes walked. It's like when you're sitting for 2 hours in a movie and then you get up and your legs are like,
There was
we're not done sitting.
There was some moseying. There was some sauntering. There
it was
beautiful.
Some it was a great,
galloping.
I have the montage in my mind.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I wish I could just take it out with one of those Harry Potter spells.
Well, anyway, you might not be able to do that for our audience.
Dumbledore.
But there's a chance that we'll be able to be presenting you a recording of that panel in a future episode. We're working hard to see if we can get that excavated and edited
yeah.
and produced for you, hoping, fingers crossed, that we can get that to you maybe as early as next week. So keep listening. It's going
to
be a great one.
It was really important to chat about the economic models that survive in an independent venue realm, balancing obviously community building and succeeding as an individual, thriving as a non-profit as well. And then another thing that we chatted about was how communities involve small and large independent venues alike. So the misconception about how independent means small. And I love that conversation. So tune in a few weeks for that chat. But without further ado, let's introduce our guest this week, who has a new album coming out on Friday.
We're 2 days away from the album drop. That's pretty exciting stuff.
Even just listening to his recordings, it's clear that Andrew Bird, our guest, has been playing violin since 4 years of age, but his music is really more than his impeccable technique. Records like Mysterious Production of Eggs, Armchair Apocrypha, and yes, his brand new record, My Finest Work Yet, taps into a vibrant labyrinth, inner world of heady emotion, obscure reference, and really brilliant songwriting. It's truly wonderful. I was so glad to chat to him.
And across this incredible chat, you and Andrew work through almost his entire career in all of its elaborate glory. You've got his first performances as a child playing violin, seeing Japanese noise rockers Boredoms in his first concert, which I am so insanely jealous of. It was Chicago, it was the Metro, which is an amazing venue, all the way back in
the
90s.
That was one of our best stories.
I love it. You also talk about his time with the Squirrel Nut Zippers. You talk about building his own band all the way up through having released now more than 10 solo albums in 2 decades, which is an incredible run.
And the best news is that we have an early taste of the album. If you haven't heard this song yet, you are in for a treat. We have Sisyphus that we're going to play just before the interview, so stay tuned.
And once you've heard the entire interview, leave us a note about it on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all your social media at TMBTGpod. Better yet, leave us a best concert experience, your first concert experience, as a story in the shape of a 5-star review on Apple Podcast, maybe, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can find us on Stitcher, on Spotify, anywhere. We'll shout you out if you leave us one of those reviews. This week, we have a special shout out for someone going by the name Marga Littleface. It all runs in together in one word.
We have the best listeners.
It's true. Thanks for the wonderful words of support, Margo Littleface. Keep being awesome.
Yeah, great. But let us not be delayed. Oh, I wish I could whistle. Doot, doot, loo, loo. I sound like Nardwar.
Oh, that was just Nardwar.
I'm sorry, Andrew. I can never whistle like you. Here's us. Enjoy.
Stone's throw from the precipice paws. Did he jump or did he fall as he gazed into the morning mist? Did he raise both fists and say to hell with this suggest? Let the rock roll. Let it roll, let it crash down low. There's a house down there, but I lost it long. Thank you.
taciturn. You know I'd rather turn and burn a scale instead of fist, yeah. Where's my accomplice? So take my hand, we'll do more than stand. Take my hand, we'll claim this land. Take my hand and we'll let the rock roll.
This is Andrew Bird.
Hi, Andrew. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. Thank you for calling so promptly on time.
Yeah, you know, it's a tight schedule.
Yes, absolutely. It's kind of unnatural, the process, right? Because it isn't out there, and I suppose that's just an extension, writing the songs and recording the songs and then taking it out on tour. All of those are kind of compartmentalized. You know, each of them lend a hand toward your music. So without that extra leg, you know, attached, like the tour hasn't happened yet or the album hasn't come out yet, I can imagine it feeling a little strange.
Yeah, I enjoy the early stages of the writing process when things are not finished yet, and I kind of like showing my work before it's finished. I like, which is, I don't think a lot of artists would say that.
Yes. But,
I just really enjoy when things are more fluid and could go in any direction, and I wish I could always be in that state. I kind of crave like dialogue as I'm working on it. It doesn't feel right to have it all in my head until it comes out.
Mm, you know? Right. What do you like about that fluidity and that you know, that it can change, and obviously listening to other people's interpretation of it and or collaborating? What do you love about that process?
It's a bit of a flush of embarrassment of showing something for the first time when it's happened.
Yes.
That's a rush. Embarrassment is a rush. So the blood goes to the head. But I also like, even if I'm not having like a comments box on the way out of the theater, I still like just the idea that there's a dialogue with the audience, that someone could say, I think you should go this way with it, or, you know, I'd probably bristle if I actually did get comments like that.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah. But so I read that you started playing violin at a really young age. I'm not sure if that was right or that was just...
when I was four.
Okay. I mean, did you always have a sense that you would be a musician or an artist of some kind?
No. It was just something that I did, you know, twice a week and was relatively good at. It didn't really kick in until, I mean, I was good and I was consistent at it until I was 14 or 15. And then I was like, you know, things aren't going well in high school. And I'm like, well, I'm actually already pretty good at this. So then I threw myself into it, and it became this sort of romantic artistic struggle.
Right.
Master the instrument.
Yeah. Were your parents musically inclined? Why did you pick that up when you were so young? What was the...
No musicians in the family for generations that I know of.
Okay.
But my mom is an artist, is a print artist, and she had this notion of her children playing classical music. So she gets the credit for...
Yeah.
I mean, she was great. It's a huge commitment. It's not like just send the kid off to
lessons.
Mm. She had to learn violin with me, so there's solidarity. And so, yeah, it just stuck with me. All my other siblings did it, but they didn't take to it.
And you said that school wasn't really going right. Was that just because you just didn't fit into the academic life, or what was the...
Yeah, there's that. I tested really poorly. They thought I was... that I had learning disabilities, and my oldest brother is autistic, so I thought I was following in his I thought I had late onset autism, and yeah, just general awkwardness and shyness, I a lot of people could say they had a rough go of it in those years.
Was music then playing in your house? Was that anything that was really around you? Because you mentioned, obviously, that there weren't any musicians, but it seems like you had a lot of support from your family. So
yeah.
Was music around the house then when you were young?
You know, my mom played classical music. My dad played country music.
Oh, right. Okay.
On the stereo. So there was the kind of highbrow, lowbrow thing going on. But in general, my family was a sanctuary from the world, and so then music became as well.
I know that you also obviously started young with performing as well, because I suppose that comes hand in hand with classical music. You know, you land up performing in recitals and all of that sort of thing. So were those like really early performances when you had to get up on stage in front of a bunch of strangers? How much of that do you remember? Because I find it so interesting, just the concept of, you know, putting kids in front of something, which I suppose when you're young, you don't really feel that nervousness. Because you don't know what, you know, you don't have the wisdom of knowing how potentially scary it could be.
Yeah, I didn't really have I don't remember having any stage fright whatsoever. In fact, when I would get in front of, I would be very shy and awkward and anxious. But as soon as I would get in front of an audience, I would feel calm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was grew up on the North Shore of Chicago, which was, you know, a lot of, you know, prodigies being cultivated. I just remember around me there being these 5 and 6 year old kids that could play these incredibly difficult, you know, Tchaikovsky violin concerto, and there was this culture around it of like, isn't this extraordinary? Like this, there was a lot of talk of like giftedness and genius and all this stuff, and it was all kind of sideshow. It was just kind of a circus, you know?
What, just exploitative or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think my mom sensed that, and she protected me from that. Like there was like a husband and wife teacher combo that would take these kids and turn them into, you know, that thing. And they wanted to take me as a student, and she resisted. She tried to keep it, you know, not too heavy for me, because it was a very competitive environment.
I wonder why it's like that, especially I live in Chicago now. I just moved a few years ago. I suppose that's all over the world, but there's so many opportunities in the States for anybody really to make it on a national scale if you push hard enough. So that's so interesting
I don't think it's that. They like to say, like, look, it's magical.
Yeah.
Like, they're gifted.
Yes.
And it's like, no, a child has a tremendous amount of room in their brain to...
Right.
And they're soaking it up like language at that age. So they can do extraordinary things, and they're being coached super hard. And it doesn't tend to go so well for them, you know? But I don't understand in our culture why there's that like we don't want to believe that it's actually hard work or time. We want to believe that it's magical.
make it thing, get onto TV. I think I was speaking to somebody the other day and they mentioned a very big pop star, and they mentioned how they grew up just looking at cereal boxes, you know, on the cereal box would be an advertisement of the Star Search or something like that. And obviously in my culture, there was nothing like that in South Africa, just because, you know, you can't really... You have to work. You have to hustle. But I wonder how it is now for kids, especially with everything going on and how readily available and accessible people and things are. You know, not only you can find out about something within 2 minutes, but also you can probably gain a lot of popularity just by having like a YouTube channel, you know, and just chatting, which is, there's nothing wrong with that. It's relatable to kids, but I think that's interesting. How that shifted.
Yeah, I think that's probably similar to being a prodigy, and that you can burn out early.
Mm.
I mean, how can you ever match that peak of playing with an orchestra, playing Tchaikovsky with an orchestra when you're six, you know?
Mm. Yeah, right.
And then you've got a long life ahead of you. Where does it go from there?
So when your mom obviously noticed that things were, you know, she wanted to make sure that you were happy and almost in essence safe, and really just harnessing your talent and discipline, what was the first concert then that you landed up seeing? Was it something from your peers at school, or did you actually get to go and see someone perform live?
We didn't go to that many. We would go to Ravinia sometimes, and I worked there when I was in high school, and I would see concerts there. But so it was mostly in the classical vein, even through high school, and, you know, NXS would play, and everyone would have that T-shirt the next day.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I would notice that, but it never occurred to me that I would go to one of those concerts. And it wasn't until my first rock and roll concert wasn't until I was maybe 19 or 20 I saw the Boredoms at the Metro.
Mm. Wow.
Which is this Japanese noise band. And pretty theatrical, though. And so that made a huge impression on me. It was this crazy show where the band is on stage and then they're just sitting there and there's two drummers. One is this giant guy and then one is... this very small Japanese woman, and this frequency starts building up in the speakers, like from very low and getting louder and higher and building anticipation. And then the singer runs out with the microphone in his mouth and he has those like sunbathing blinders on.
Yeah.
From burning your eyes or whatever. So he's, I think, effectively blind. And he just jumps right into the crowd.
Oh my gosh!
Before anything happens, there's anticipation, and then there's this, you know. He goes.
He attacks.
Throttle.
Yeah. Are you talking about? I think his surname is I. I can't remember his.
Yeah.
I must look
Shimoto
it up.
I.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So then, once I was, you know, I was at Northwestern, and I was into all sorts of stuff. I would go down to like the Jazz Showcase and see, you know, Elvin Jones and all these great jazz players. I definitely, as soon as I was close to Chicago, you know, went to as many great shows as I could. But I still wasn't particularly into pop music per se. Like I would be pulled out. Friends would take me to the shows, but I was still into more fancy music than the sort of indie rock or...
Right.
You know, I remember seeing Pavement and, you know, I would go to Lounge Acts a lot. And I honestly, for the first few years, I didn't really get it.
I mean, you can tell by the music that you make. I like that you call it fancy music. Not necessarily your own, but the things that you liked. What made it... Is it just because it was technically... much more advanced than what you were used to, something where you really appreciated the technical aspect of it, and obviously the performance style was totally unique as well.
Yeah, I mean, I was so typical week for me when I was 20 or 21 would be, I'd be in an orchestra during the week playing Shostakovich or Mahler, and then on Sundays I would go to the Abbey Pub and play Irish sessions. And then all the while I would be transcribing like a John Coltrane solo for my ethnomusicology jazz class.
Oh, wow.
But I was still learn. I still was, even as complicated as the music would get, I would still do it all by ear. I could read, but I didn't enjoy reading. So I would just soak it up as much as I could by ear. That Irish session or whatever on Sundays was drinking Guinness and kind of sharing tunes. And it was kind of a good antidote to the rather uptight atmosphere of the orchestra.
Kind of, yeah.
It was, whether it was Strauss or an Irish tune or Coltrane, it was all, I didn't really distinguish that much in the way I approached it. It took me a while to realize, like, to understand where in the mid-90s Chicago indie rock, what the sort of DIY punk ethos was really all about. But once I did eventually get it and appreciate it.
You moved toward that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. You studied performance in college as well, right? Or were you
violin performance.
Okay.
Which sounds pretty specific.
It does. But how much of that experience, and also you mentioned jazz ethnomusicology, which is fascinating as well, just on its own, really. But how much of that experience then do you still rely on today? What sort of, I suppose I'm just wondering, what sort of things you were exposed to that allowed you to really pursue a career as a full-time musician as well? Or is it completely separate?
I don't know if I'm answering it, but I'll just say this. When I was in music school, I was not the ideal student. I never really was. And I was kind of pushing back against my teachers a bit. And I could see that if I did what was expected of me, I might not be able to make a go of it. You know, if I followed in the path of what institution was suggesting, that I could see at some point I just had to, as soon as I got out of music school, I was like, oh, that's not that hard. I understand how this works. And they were it made such a fuss, you know. I always resisted methodology and pedagogy. And I think that served me in the end. I'm still just kind of go by intuition, and in my writing, it's not a verse chorus kind of method. I'm just always just grasping in the dark for things. What eventually made sense to me about the more of the indie scene and trying to write a good pop song, was, you know, all my people around me in the arts, whether they're in theater or whatever, or visual artists, who are waiting for someone to tap them and say, okay, you're good. You're in now.
You're in, yeah.
You're going around with your headshots to waiting for someone to say, okay, you're good. And I realized that was never going to happen. And maybe I didn't even want it to happen. So you just have to make your own, book your own show and make your own poster and go around town on your bike and put up posters and conceive of the whole album and the artwork and the whole picture, the whole package. And that was in my 20s in Chicago. That's what I was figuring out.
But I mean, even your first recordings, you know, you mentioned like grasping in the dark and obviously resisting methods and methodology and format like that, but your first recordings work on so many different genres and pockets of genres, you know, within music of hair, as well as your work with Squirrel Nut Zippers. There's so much there. And even, you know, listening to your latest album as well, which I love the title, My Finest Work Yet. Very bold title. I really like it. So how did you approach that in terms of, I suppose, you know, each genre and giving it its due? Or was it just about finding emotion for a melody, for your feeling, for the song? Like, how much of it was really where you sat down and thought, I need to technically, you know, think about mashing all these genres together in the best possible way? It was just completely authentic and natural to you.
Yeah, I mean, before I really figured it out, I like Music of Hair, for instance, is partitioned like into three segments that were into the three main things that I was into, because I didn't know what I was doing. I was just thinking, oh, I'm going to try to make a living as a musician. I should have this almost like a demo record of all the things that I can do. Then I kind of got swept up in the early jazz, early 20th century kind of thing for the first couple of Bowl of Fire records. And then, you know, at around age 26 or 27, I look at those records in that period as being, I was still a student, you know. I still would walk into record stores and think, what can I learn from these records?
Mm.
What can I incorporate into what I'm doing? How can I make it my own? But, you know, it was still, I was still working off the textbook of my favorite records.
Right. What and, were your favorite records in at that time?
Oh, man, it was so...
Or still, maybe now even.
It was kind of all over the place, but at that time it was like, I was very into like Anglo-Irish folk music, Waterson Carthy, Nick Drake, and there was that thing. And then there was sort of the early jazz, Django, hot jazz kind of thing I was into. I was into Latin music, Afro-Cuban. I was just into so much different stuff. It was throwing myself into a different thing every week.
But I love that. I feel like as a musician, there's something special about hearing that you were a fan amongst it all as well. You know, there's so often those two things are never really mentioned. You can assume somebody is a fan of the art or the discipline that they are a part of, but the fact that it sounds like you were inspired a lot, not necessarily to replicate the sounds, but really just to, as you said, grasp into the darkness. I really like that line for your own work. I think that's really fascinating.
Yeah. It was just, you know, when you first start putting records out into the world, you start to realize, oh, I could possibly create expectations or paint myself into a corner with some of these stylistic references. So the turning point was a little bit with Swimming Hour, but Weather Systems was kind of the real rethinking of how I was soaking things up and processing them. And yeah, I think Weather Systems was more of like a natural amalgam of all these things, without being any one thing.
Because your songs always have that history of self-reference, adaptation, and almost intertextuality. You know, there's that idea, you know, that you're constantly working at it as opposed to against it or for it, you know.
it feels
like it's next to you. But so was that a part of your writing? Like, what inspired that inward look?
I wasn't thinking I need to do this. It coincides with a major shift in geography. Like, I moved out of Chicago and fixed up an old barn in Western Illinois and thought I was going to bring my band out to record the next record in my own studio. You know, what you're usually working towards is like, I'm going to have my own studio and be able to work anytime. And it didn't really work out that way. Like, none of my friends, my band, no one had a car, so they couldn't come out. It was just a logistical issue. So I was out there for weeks on end, and I started doing the looping thing, and I started experimenting with my environment, with what I was seeing, and how that affected my phrasing, and how my phrasing affected what I was seeing. Being out in the country, and I didn't bring any records with me when I moved out there. That's not true. I had two records. I had Lowe's Trust and
Amazing.
The Kinks, Preservation Green.
Oh wow! I love the Kinks.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
So those two records, one was very sad and minimalistic, and one was kind of upbeat and dense songwriting. And mostly I was in a deprivation chamber of sorts. I didn't realize that that's what I really needed, was to deprive myself of all my friends' record collections and my own record collection to see what was really going on in there.
Yeah, just to strip it away. And when I said inward, of course it's juxtaposed by some incredibly eloquent diction, you know, as well as you've got some references to such a diverse swath of culture and mythology. And so when you took everything away and you moved away, I love, you know, obviously mentioning that it was geography of it all, but did that inspiration strike from the fact that you had taken yourself away, or did you have to actively sit and search and create a almost extension of who you have been?
I think I just had to cut out the noise to find out what kind of music I was really hearing. With the lyric writing, it's just there were fewer distractions. I could go into these internal conversations and just sometimes just desperately trying to entertain yourself. It was very intense solitude, it could only last so long. I couldn't really, it wasn't healthy. But I did form this like very direct pipeline between experimenting with what I was working on and going straight to a stage to play it. Like I was playing solo, living in a barn by myself, and I was going off in my van with my amps and going, you know, from town to town, doing everything myself, like loading in, loading out, doing merch, talking to people. And it was a pretty intense period.
I
kept thinking, I got to be doing some damage to myself here.
Yeah.
Not only is this like socially warping,
isolating.
Yeah.
I can imagine, as you said, you know, that can really do a number on you, but I also can imagine that teaches you humility of being a touring artist as well, as opposed to having everything just done for you. Of course, it speaks to a lot of self-control and having control to maybe too much. So how has that really changed and shifted over the years?
From that period on, like, I kind of slowly assimilated back into a normal community. Some degree, but still, you know, the alienation feeling of being only communicating with people when you're on stage or in interviews, and always being out of town and coming back and being disconnected from friends, that continued through like years of being in Chicago. That it got so intense, like up to around Noble Beast, and I was playing over 200 shows a year, and I was sick all the time, and I was just like really not well in both physically and mentally. And I was thinking about like, okay, I think I've tipped the scale a little too far. You know, it starts for a while, it feeds you, and then it crosses over and it starts sucking you dry, and you start thinking about like, how am I living, you know, when you're open to criticism for the work you're doing, and it's like it's completely consumed you, so it's so personal. There is a period there where it got pretty critical, and then I think I pulled it back together.
Yeah, because I suppose feeling live as well, it's feeling like you're playing live all the time is also really difficult to open yourself up to, not only criticism but just that energy, you know, emanating from a crowd, no matter whether it's positive or negative, it's still something. And you know, how the dichotomy of having that crazy moment of performing live versus being quiet in your bedroom moments later is really difficult to balance. How did you notice that you were kind of going down a path that felt like it was detrimental to your physical and mental health? How did you stop that and notice? Because it's difficult when you're so in it, especially after playing so many shows. You said 200 or something for, you know, in a short amount of time. So how did you really yank yourself back from falling over?
I don't know. I've came back from a tour of Asia, of playing China and Japan, and I didn't want to go back to Chicago, and I just stopped in Los Angeles and rented a place from a friend in Venice, and I just kind of decompressed for about 6 months and going clean a little bit. Yeah, I just had to, I don't know. I feel way more healthy now, and I think it has to do with just, you know, meeting my wife and starting a family and just better life balance.
Yeah, and having that support, absolutely. I mean, thank you for sharing that. You know, I don't take any of that lightly. I suppose you have to be very gentle towards yourself now and also who you were in the past, because that's informed who you have become. But obviously when you're performing live as well, you always have these giant horns, you know, some of which spin to produce that sort of Doppler effect, and you've got all these things going on and your loop pedals. So how involved going forward now with My Finest Work Yet, which is coming out, when is that coming out? Is it next week?
Friday.
Friday already. Well, when this episode goes out, it will be in a few days time, Friday. So what sort of technology or change in the makeup of the live performance are you working on for this particular set of songs?
Well, I mean, I can play every one of these songs with just a guitar, which is the first for me. There's no crazy looping necessary to, and I've already done a couple, like I did an in-store at Rough Trade in London. It was like totally, I'm like, hey, I'm just a songwriter through the door with a guitar for once.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
There's no bells and whistles or crazy horns. But that being said, you know, for the live show, I've got a lot of new elements. Like we've got the acoustic piano and this wonderful player, Tyler Chester, and the song, the record has a, you know, that sound throughout, which is a new element. I've got Madison Cunningham, who's just a phenomenal singer and songwriter, you know, singing with me. Feels like very soulful stuff to sing, you know. I just want to write songs now that I can get to that place that I enjoy on stage, of like just being totally, it's a feeling of just connectedness when it's really going right, and what I really enjoy about performing, it's just when everything's resonating and connecting, and there's nothing like it. And it doesn't require, with previous bands, like playing with Martin Dash, we went to the limits of complexity as far as like looping and thinking drums with loops and sending my signal around to different instruments on stage, and this record for the most part is a guy singing with a guitar with a band.
There's so much more.
I don't want to give the impression that it's just like middle of the road, you know.
It's a shift for sure, and I feel like that simplicity weirdly has created quite complex moments along the album. You know, there's a lot of times when it's more orchestral and those instruments, you just let it kind of breathe in your songs. Are, you know, some songs are like Bloodless, I think, is, you know, it's past the 3 minute, 4 minute mark, and you repeat it later in the album. Manifest is a great track, an example of that, I feel. And when I read the bio, I was interested in what you were speaking about, but you sound lighter, which maybe it's strange because you may have written it when you were heavier, but you definitely sound, and I'm not talking about the lack of all those gadgets and things that you used to use, but your spirit sounds lighter, which is maybe a strange thing to say.
Yeah, no,
I don't know if that's agree.
I've just done a little, I did a little run over to Paris and London, and talking about the record is just so much, I don't know, it's just easier to talk about, and to, as heavy as some of these subjects are, you know, the previous record got really dark too, and I didn't enjoy talking about that. I kind of realized why some people don't like talking about their songs, when they get very personal. And I've known that from the first record I made. There's whenever I write a song about someone that's not me,
right?
You feel dirty. You feel like you might be exploiting that It's fine when you're doing it for an audience, but when it gets into a larger forum, it feels like a not a very pure exchange going on. And I just wrote the songs this time that they're a result of being alive at this time. It's not, there wasn't any directive per se, but yeah.
But it still sounds like you, which is something, you know, there's that whole talk behind signature sound and an artist keeping to them, you know, to what they know. But there's something, as I said, really breathes, and it does feel this like the spirit is lighter. But I love that you titled the album as you did, because it kind of disconnects to the whole. When you listen, you're not so focused on the title of the album as you are, you know, the technical side of the actual songwriting, right. You know, it doesn't get in the way. And I really like that you called it that. And I'm sure you've been asked loads of times why you committed to that title. But I think what I'm more interested in is, you know, why has it taken so long, I suppose, for you to, you know, because it's obviously, I'm sure you feel committed to the title as well.
Mm-hmm.
Or did you just, I'm overthinking it, and you're like, Leo, this is, you know,
I went through over 100 possible titles.
Oh, really?
They all seemed incredibly lame to me. At record number 14, you keep naming, here's another body of work, I got to give it a name. And it just seems like, oh, another poetic thing that's trying to encapsulate everything you're talking
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it just became so... just felt so tired, and I had this working title, My Finest Work Yet, is just sort of an inside joke between me and myself, or me and my manager, or people that I share music with first. And so I just have to call it something, and I just a way of just poking fun at this whole endeavor. And it kind of came back after I just gave up on something that had to have, like, you know, encapsulate 4 years of struggle and work, you know. I was like, yeah, that's it. I still haven't quite figured out how to play it. In interviews, a lot of people are like, so is this your finest work yet?
Yeah, that's what I can imagine you're getting. Like, it's not that you're saying it's your finest work yet. It just sounds...
No.
It's which I feel like it might as well be, but it sounds very tongue in cheek, which is kind of a nice light-hearted way of looking at yourself. And I think that harkens back to you mentioning how enlivened you felt in the beginning by sharing songs when, you know, it made you embarrassed, and you like that.
I like titles that have multiple interpretations.
Sure.
This one can be taken in so many ways, and those who get the joke get the joke. Those who don't, they're subject to power of suggestion. And I'll be like, well, maybe it is actually the science work yet.
Yeah.
But I just feel like record number 14, like, who am I kidding? Like,
it's crazy.
Anyway, haven't I don't have the right at this point to have some fun with the whole business. You know, it gets so damn serious.
Yeah, and so how do you, going forward, how do you feel like you are prepped to have this out there in the world? Like, what are you going to do in the live setup? Because I know you just mentioned you went to Paris and London. So what are you going to do to make yourself feel like you're having the most fun while doing this crazy job that can easily consume you, you know?
I don't know, man. I just did a couple shows at Largo, where we play the whole record down, and it's definitely songs that feed me. You know, they're not overwritten, and they're not boxing me in, and that's all I could hope for. That's totally my goal when I'm writing now, because I think about this being on stage when I write. Like, I think about the next 2.5 years of doing hundreds of shows of this material, and I know well enough now, like, what kind of song has the longest shelf life.
Yes.
And I know well enough that, I experimented early on with, like, lightness and dark and the contrast of lyrics against music, and I just follow my impulses musically and with melody and texture purely for the enjoyment of those things. Let the lyrics fall on top of it, and sometimes it can seem even more sinister the more upbeat it is. You know, you're seething through your grin a little bit. That's always been more interesting and more powerful to me than rage on rage.
Totally. Yeah. This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kibble, and we'd like to thank Billy Yost and The Kickback for our theme song, Rube, and buy their music at thekickbackband.com. Lexi Frame for the artwork, Daniel Brater and Dean Berger for the additional sound design, and the Consequence Podcast Network, where you'll find a bunch of other amazing shows. Hey! If you've listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts? Your comments provide valuable feedback for us, and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod. And generally, just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again. Miss you already.
Consequence Podcast Network.